of peasants. Well, that wonderful paragraph is a mark of the return of Arcadia. That actually when hunting starts to look like a stupid and gross relationship to the natural world, then the Arcadian ideas of concordance, the desire not to dominate the natural, but to somehow be at home with it, is on its way back.
Dark Arcadias was presented by Adam Nicholson and produced in Bristol by Tim Dee. And in the second part, tomorrow evening, Adam concludes his survey in the downlands of southern England and by chopping logs on a Highland estate. That's at 10 o'clock tomorrow night. Meanwhile, in three essays this week, three writers have also been pursuing the theme of dark Arcadias across children's literature, poetry and modern country houses. The second in the series is here on BBC Radio 3 in a quarter of an hour. After this, in fact, another selection of music and poetry from a Proms Plus Late event. It took place after last Saturday's prom and it's introduced by Petroc Trelawney.
Welcome to the Elgar Room here at the Royal Albert Hall for Proms Plus Lates, music and poetry once a week after the music has finished in the great hall beneath us. This evening we welcome the Dialogues trio to the stage. Bruno Heinen, pianist who entertained us a couple of weeks ago, is back this evening. We'll hear from them very shortly. First of all, a poet whose first poetry collection, Pelt, has just been published by Bladax. She's going to be reading from it this evening. Would you please welcome to the stage Sarah Jackson.
Clam. The beach at night is my body. You taught me this, and how goose barnacles will slit your wrists if you're not careful. Tonight, I am fused with clams. They stick upright like my sister's fingernails or bunches of car keys. And when I try to run away from myself, they slice the soles of my bare blue feet. I've never seen so much water. It sluices through my bones like your sperm, your spit, cold crawling up inside me, coming home in my chest. You taught me about mollusks too, how they have tongues for feet and kill dog whelks by tethering them to rock until they starve to death. You always find me, dragging me out of the sea again. The water pours out of me again, your boots snapping the clams like children clapping.
Thank you.
vocal cords. I breakfast at the side of the house where an old Breton plaque rusts in the gravel beneath the window. And there flies worship the sparrow, which lies head bent right back with its beak snapped clean off like the lid of the margarine tub. I bend down, lift the beak between my finger and thumb, look into the hollow of its throat to see its vocal cords nestling like a peach stone, wondering where music comes from and where my voice has gone.
Thank you.
remains. 1. Today, I find I can see through my eyelids. You are curled over yourself as if reading, but there is no book. I wait, counting the dogwood on the curtain, listening for the telephone. You sit in a winged armchair by my head, holding your elbows. I smell you, dirty and sweet. I think of the way I might have said goodbye. We tried not to speak of such things. You turned and your hot face was bright. I saw myself reflected in it as I left. 2. The room grows cold. I am not arranged in a line. Lift me, please, from my crookedness. We need to start again, but it is always too late, and I am afraid you do not know how to begin. 3. Love, you surprise me. Turning, dipping a cloth in a shallow bowl, you wipe my palms in slow circles and twist my rings so that everything is facing one way. This is touch without touching, as it always is. You are so quiet, sounds slip from the ceiling. I am afraid of you, of your gentleness. You say, nothing will remain, and I hear my bones in your voice. At home, the dog will always be searching. Thanks a lot.
Was Cancer from Tierkreis Zodiac by Karlheinz, Stockhausen arranged by Bruno Heinen, and played by the Dialogues Trio with poetry by Sarah Jackson. And those were highlights from the Proms Plus late event recorded at the Elgar Room at the Royal Albert Hall last Saturday evening. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 14 minutes to 11. Well, now our essay in this week's programme is around two features that also explore the idea. Three writers are investigating dark Arcadias. Tonight, Nigel Leask of Glasgow University explores the Arcadian visions of the ploughman poet Robert Burns.
My own Arcadia is caught up in childhood memories from the early 60s. Growing up in a white house at the foot of the Campsie Fells in semi-rural Stirlingshire, on the road from Strathblane to Lennoxton. There were green craggy hills behind and ploughed fields stretching down to the burn, and then up beyond, boggy Craigan Muir with its quarry and dark spruce plantations. Due south, invisible, but just 9 miles or so over the hill, the reek of Glasgow, tenement demolitions, rising unemployment, thick winter smogs. I was just too young to witness the last steam trains plying their way down the valley in front of our house, on the branch line from Kirkintilloch to Aberfoyle, but I do remember the Fergie tractors at the winter ploughing, harried by lines of screaming seagulls. Saturday walks up the hill to Balaghan Spout, drinking warm milk from the udder at Dawson's Farm, the kirk on Sunday, the smell of damp hymn books and Presbyterian sanctity. Although like many Scottish villages and towns, Strathblane was proud of its Burns Club, I was a latecomer to the poetry of Robert Burns. I wasn't oblivious of the Brigadoon aura surrounding the poet's birthplace, but Burns's Ayrshire seemed distant, far away south, beyond Glasgow, over the Clyde. My mother's family hailed from Bothwell in Lanarkshire, so there was a wee bust of David Livingstone in the house, but no Robbie Burns. Yet mine were the same lowlands as his, exactly 2 centuries on. Once farming country, Strathblane's growth at the turn of the 18th century was linked to bleaching and calico printing, and a similar combination of farming and village industry was also a feature of Burns's Ayrshire, even if coal mining was only just starting to transform its green pastoral landscape. A Gaelic presence is reflected in many of the place names of both, as well as the dark ridge of the Highlands that dominates the distant horizons. Despite poet Burns, Lowland Scotland lacked the romantic appeal of the Highlands for foreign travellers. John Keats felt depressed when he visited Burns's tomb at Dumfries during his 1818 tour. The clouds, the sky, the houses all seem anti-Grecian. Although he was moved by the beauty of the poet's Ayrshire, he wrote a bad sonnet in the birthplace cottage and complained that Burns talked with bitches, he drank with blackguards, he was miserable. I lived for nearly 25 years in the south of England before returning to Glasgow in 2004. And as a teacher of romantic literature, I often pondered Keats's comment about the anti-Grecian quality of the Scots lowlands. It didn't ring true for my native Stirlingshire, even in my least homesick moments, and I doubted if it rang true for Burns's Ayrshire either. Granted, even by a stretch of imagination, the rainy climate, grey skies and green hills of lowland Scotland were hardly Grecian, but nevertheless the country had its own pastoral beauty, even after the ravages of coal mining and piecemeal industrialisation. Yellow flowering whin and late summer light, green fields bordered by rushes, crumbling dry-stained dykes, the song of skylarks, the old Scots name Lavrocks is even better, tugged by the campsy winds, and sheep grazing everywhere. Yet perhaps, after all, Keats was alert to a shadow lying at the heart of Robert Burns's Scots pastoral. Writing as the heaven-taught ploughman in the preface to his 1786 Kilmarnock poems, Burns denied that he'd sought for a rural theme with an eye to Theocrates or Virgil, insisting that he was a literal rather than a literary pastoralist. He gave the lie to this claim, however, in a fragment on pastoral poetry drafted about the same time, a poem which, despite his ignorance of Greek and superficial command of Latin, shows a considerable knowledge of the pastoral tradition, and which praised his precursor, the 18th century poet Alan Ramsay, as the Theocritus of Scotland. Thou paints old nature to the nines in thy sweet Caledonian lines. This was clearly a manifesto for the kind of poetry to which Burns himself aspired, its artful combination of Scots idiom and Augustan English, adapting the mixed register of rural Doric dialect and literary Greek in the idylls of Theocritus. Although Burns was always harping on about his independence at the plough, in fact he wasn't a ploughman but a severely undercapitalised tenant farmer, caught up in the whirlwind of Scotland's agricultural revolution. In 1787 he described the failure of the joint tenancy of Mosgiel Farm, upon which he'd embarked with his brother Gilbert. I read farming books, I calculated crops, I attended markets, and in short, in spite of the devil, the world and the flesh, I believe I would have been a wise man. But the first year from unfortunately buying in bad seed, the second from a late harvest, we lost half of both our crops. This overset all my wisdom, and I returned like a dog to his vomit. Well read in the literature of agricultural improvement, Burns had won a premium for growing flax, the wonder crop of the 1780s, experimented with sheep and cattle breeding, and was an expert on soil chemistry. He also knew how to prospect for lime deposits to enrich the acidic soils of Mosgiel and Ellisland farms. But soaring rents, exaggerated landlord expectations, chronic lack of capital, as well as crop failure in the mini ice age of the early 1780s, transformed Burns's Ayrshire into a dark Arcadia. Like the shepherd Melibaeus and Virgil's first eclogue, he faced the prospect of economic ruin and exile, buying himself a passage to Jamaica to work as a Negro driver on a slave plantation at Port Antonio. Unaccountably, it was during these crisis years in 1783-5 that he began to write poetry, and it was the success of his 1786 Kilmarnock volume that saved him from exile. Burns's predicament is reflected in his view of nature. His beautiful love song, Now Westland Winds and Slochtering Guns, is an early composition written when he was 15, inspired by his teenage harvesting companion, Nellie Kilpatrick. Alluding to Pope's Winds of Forest and James Thomson's The Seasons, the song's also attentive to indigenous flora and fauna. Of the estimated 41 individual bird names mentioned in Burns's writings, 9 appear here, often in the old Scots nomenclature. In the following extract, Pertrick is partridge, cushat, the wood pigeon. The pertrick lose the fruit for fells, the plover lose the mountain, the woodcock haunts the lanely dells, the soaring heron the fountains. Through lofty groves the cushat roves, the path of man to shun it, the hazel bush o'erhangs the thrush, the spreading thorn the linnet. Burns's allusion to the fearful cushat suggests here that the harmonious relationship between man and nature is out of joint, a suggestion confirmed in the next stanza. Thus every kind their pleasure find, the savage and the tender, some social join and leagues combine, some solitary wander. Avaunt, away, the cruel sway, tyrannic man's dominion, the sportsman's joy, the murdering cry, the fluttering gory pinion. Only the poet's peaceful love for his Peggy dear and the courting couple's enjoyment of the charms of nature in the final stanzas redeem the human tyranny upon which the sportsman's joy is premised. It's a fact that Burns's sympathy for the human victims of the agricultural revolution, especially cleared cotters and labourers, was often displaced in his poetry into a concern for animals, farm dogs, superannuated plough horses, tethered sheep, even homeless mice. To a mouse, on turning her up in her nest with a plough, November 1785, is justly hailed as his greatest nature poem. Employing a tender and solicitous Scots diction, exploiting the homiletic potential of the habby stanza to the full, it's rich in naturalistic observation, its address softened by sibilance and diminutives. Note the masterful switch from the colloquial Scots of the first stanza, "We sleekit cowrin timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie," to the Augustan English of the second, dilating on the disharmony between man and nature. "I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union." Burns alludes here to Alexander Pope's Essay on Man, which describes an ecological golden age when man walked with beast, joint tenant of the shade, the same his table and the same his bed. No murder clothed him and no murder fed. The poem's narrator reassures the mouse that this farmer, at least, is willing to spare the life of a fellow mortal, even if most would have destroyed it with murdering pattle. It's a tribute to Burns's mastery of register that his apology retains a colloquial lightness of touch, rather than sinking under the freight of its Popian illusion. In the third stanza, the poem acknowledges the claims of the mouse's bare life against the criminality of scavenging. "I doubt no whiles, but thou may thieve. What then, poor beastie, thou mun live?" He continues by invoking the minimal portion of the farmer's corn requested by the mouse as a form of charitable gleaning. "A daemon icker in a thraves a small request." Burns glosses this densely colloquial Ayrshire idiom as "an ear of corn now and then." Whether or not one believes that the mouse possesses natural rights like a human, Burns describes it as "a poor, earthborn companion and fellow mortal." David Perkins has pointed out that, etymologically, the mouse is a companion, companis, in that it eats the speaker's bread or grain. It is a companion because it lives in the same place and undergoes similar experiences. The right of commons here cuts across species boundaries and includes the permission to glean, symbolising the old pre-capitalist moral economy, rather than the strict profit margins of the new agriculture. Like many of Burns's best poems, To a Mouse has a winter setting. And although the episode to which its title alludes occurs in November, bleak December winds are ensuing, baith snell and keen. This is the winter ploughing, and the harvest has long since been taken in. Despite the benevolent farmer's permission to the mouse to glean an occasional ear of corn in a stook, Gleaning is a seasonal entitlement, and now it's simply too late in the year. The pathos of the mouse's predicament is that its winter shelter and its grain store have been dispersed by the poet's plough, and without foggage green amongst the dry stubble, there's no hope of restitution. This introduces a darker mood into the poem, exposing the farmer's offer of charity as being really an empty gesture. The reflexive turn taken at the end of To a Mouse transforms the creature's sudden dehousing into a story about human eviction. More precisely, before the poet discovers an image of his own fate in the mouse's ruin, its animal predicament is very gently anthropomorphised and translated into the contemporary situation of cotters and labourers being cleared from their homes. The mouse, which, cosy here beneath the blast, thought to dwell, is now turned out to thole, to suffer, the winter's sleety dribble, and cranruch cold, the hoarfrost. As the now proverbial lines have it, the best-laid schemes o' mice and men gang after glay, and leave us nocht but grief and pain for promised joy. The final stanza suddenly exposes the poet in the nakedness of his self-pity, like the homeless mouse shivering in the cleared stubble, although unlike the farmer, the creature is mercifully oblivious of his fate. Not only is it too late in the season for the mouse's plight to be reversed, it's also too late for the ploughman either to give or, by extension, receive charity. Although this last stanza risks diffusing the poem's effect by moving from creaturely compassion to self-pity, it's artistically important for Burns to break the analogy between mice and men at the end. After all, it's a post-lapsarian poem in which man's dominion has broken nature's social union. And therefore, line 12's celebration of a compassion based on shared creaturely existence can only be momentary. Et in Arcadia ego, death has entered Arcadia. The old Scottish agricultural order, with its moral economy of provision, has felt the coulter crash of improvement. The neatly elliptical evocation of future ruination, I guess and fear, conjures the poet's troubled consciousness in lonely separation from both animal and human worlds. It also foreshadows the prospect of ruin and exile for Burns the ploughman poet, at the end of the poem exposed as the spoiler spoiled. Robert Burns's Dark Arcadia speaks powerfully to our own concerns with poverty, dispossession, and ecological disaster, while also connecting us to the humane values of an earlier agricultural and pre-industrial world.
The essay was presented by Nigel Leask and first broadcast in July last year. Well, tomorrow evening at 10 o'clock, there's a second feature by Adam Nicholson on the theme of Dark Arcadias. And after it, in another essay, Alexandra Harris explores the 20th century Arcadian fantasies of Cecil Beaton and Rex Whistler.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Elgar's The Apostles. Leading Elgar conductor Sir Mark Elder directs a cast of soloists, three choirs and the Halle Orchestra in this major and still underrated work from the British choral tradition. Friday night at the earlier time of 6:45 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online. It's a minute or so past 11. Time now for Late Junction with Verity Sharp.
Que não dá, cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. Oi, DJ, está vendo a confusão? A mistura que fizeste prejudica o meu povão. Quando ponho samba, lá vão elas a quinari. Boto tradicional e lá vão elas a bazar. Oi, DJ, está vendo que não dá, cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. Tenho saudades do grupo Baião, Lua das Rosas, Machinde, 11 bravos de quinzão. Ô DJ, tá vendo que não dá, cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar.
Tanto amo que não quis zombar. Vou escolher o salão. Respeita a minha onda. Eu não faço confusão. DJ, oh DJ, tá vendo que não dá. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. Você cresce e apareça com alguma experiência. Se cuida na aparência antes que eu me aborreça. DJ, oh DJ, tá vendo que não dá. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar e olha. Quando ponho samba, lá vão elas a quinar. Boto tradicional e lá vão elas a bazar. Oi, oh DJ, tá vendo que não dá. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. Tenho saudade do grupo Baião, Luar das Rosas, Machine, 11 bravos de quinzão. Oh, DJ, tá vendo que não dá. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. Tanto amo que não que zomba. Vou escolher o salão. Respeita a minha onda. Eu não faço confusão, DJ. Oh, DJ, tá vendo que não dá. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. Você cresce e apareça com alguma experiência. Se cuida na aparência antes que eu perco a cabeça. DJ, oh DJ, tá vendo que não dá. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar, yeah. Oi DJ, tá vendo que não dá. DJ, cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar. DJ, oh DJ, você tá vendo que não dá. Cota na disco, com os ouvidos a estalar, olha. DJ, tá vendo que não dá. Corta na disco, com os ouvidos a estalarem. Oi, DJ, tá vendo que não dá.
Well, there's a track from the latest album from the singer and ex-athlete, as it happens, Bonga from Angola, who once held the record for the 400 metres in Portugal, and he used that status as well as his music to bring attention to all the political struggles that Angola has endured over the decades. DJ Marado from Bonga's Hora Kuta, his 30th album to date. Welcome to Late Junction. This is a field recording made in the late 1960s by a Dutch woman called Kutje van Erven, who became a music teacher in Sierra Leone, where she then became fascinated with the rich creativity amongst the country's indigenous populations. And she set out to document the music by making recordings. This one was made on Plantain Island, which is one of Sierra Leone's fishing islands, and she simply describes it as a hand-clapping song.
Mare, 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 mare
Well, there's a track from another musician, or is it musicians indeed, interested in field recordings, a musical outfit that goes by the name Day Lineal, and they capture sounds using dictaphones and then use those as starting points for some quite ear-bending tracks. It's from an album called What Will You Become? And I'll play you another track later on. Here is harpist Julia Rovinsky with The Room by Harold Budd.
Água louca de ribeira, que corres em cavalgada, porque não vais devagar. Essa corrida é cegueira, não vês nem olhas para nada.